KZSU-FM Stamford, welcome to the inaugural spring edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stamford Law School. Thanks for joining me today for the spring quarter. It's been an eventful break where we were joined as a blogger. Professor Julie Cromer-Young from Thomas Jefferson Law School is going to be blogging at Hearsay Culture. And we're going to continue motoring along with the podcast. Amazingly, we're up to show 208 on the schedule that began back in May 2006. To start off the quarter, I'm excited to have on repeat guest Professor Mark Lemley from Stamford Law School. Mark has been on the show now a few times talking about patents from the very beginning of the show, and I'm excited to have him on today to go through the continued enormous amount of activity both in the Supreme Court as well as legislative around patents and patent reform. It's been an amazing few years here, well, for several really, but certainly the last few years for people practicing in patent law and as well as scholars, because it seems like the Supreme Court can't get enough of patent cases, can't get enough of dealing with federal circuit opinions that it may or may not agree with. And of course, this is great stuff not only for scholars but for practitioners as they work through these challenging issues that are, of course, critically important to the innovation economy that we have today. Mark is someone who, and I should say by caveat up front, by way of disclaimer, when I was a resident fellow at Stanford back in 05 to 07, Mark runs the law technology program at Stanford and the Center for Internet Society fell under that bailiwick. That's the disclosure. I am no longer on Stanford's payroll, so those links are more attenuated, but I mentioned that up front. But Mark has been on the show a few times to discuss these issues, and I'm excited to have him on today. We're going to be going through several cases as well as the ongoing issues around patent trolls or patent assertion entities or non-practicing entities or any number of names that have been used to describe these entities. And then we're going to go through several cases that have both a few have been decided, but cases that are pending in front of the Supreme Court and get Mark's take on those issues. As we go through those cases, of course, we will, for those of you that aren't paying close attention to the world of patent law, we will be sure not to lose you. And so therefore, we will go through some of the basics there, but we'll get into the weeds with Mark. We are recording this show on April 8th, 2014 for airing on April 9th. So this will be quite current. Many people who listen to Hearsay Culture, in fact, probably a majority, are well familiar with Mark's work. Mark is a William H. Newcomb Professor of Law at Stanford. He's also the director, as I mentioned, of the Stanford Program in Law, Science, and Technology. He's the director of Stanford's LLM Program in Law, Science, and Technology. He teaches IP. He has been cited 140 times by courts. He's written well over 100 articles, books. He's also a partner at Durek Tangri, a law firm in the Valley. He was recently listed as in the IP Hall of Fame, I believe. The accolades go on and on. Point is, Mark is one of the leading and most prolific scholars in IP law, not just now, but really ever. And that sounds like hyperbole, but it is backed up. Mark has been a friend of the show, and I'm very excited to have him on the show today. He's joining us via Skype from his office at Stanford Law School. Mark, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks, Dave. Happy to be here.
So, Mark, let's jump right in. As I mentioned in the introduction, a lot of my listeners are familiar with patent law issues. Rather than go through the general background questions that I often ask guests about your background and how you got involved, I think, like I said, enough people know your work that we can dive into some of these issues. One of the major issues, viewing this show as kind of a patent law update, as you will, what's happening right now. As I mentioned in the introduction, we've got a lot of activity really over the last year around fixing this problem as it's framed regarding patent trolls. For those that aren't familiar with this issue, and I'll let you use the phrase that you'd like, can you briefly give us the 2-minute summary of what that issue is from a policy perspective?
I'm sorry, which issue?
The issue of patent trolls or patent assertion entities.
So the problem is that the single largest business model in the patent system today is obtaining patents but not actually making products and choosing instead to sue people who do make products. And these so-called patent trolls so-called, because they live under a bridge that often they didn't build, and they pop out to demand a toll from surprised passersby, have become a real hot-button issue in the courts, but also in Congress, which is considering patent reform. Some people are concerned about the patent troll business model altogether, saying that patent trolls don't add anything to society, they're just imposing a cost. I think the reality is a little more complex than that. Patent trolls exist because there are lots of patents out there, probably too many, that are written too broadly, and it's really difficult for courts to figure out cheaply and quickly which are the good ones and which are the bad ones, which are broad and which are narrow. And so there's an opportunity for people to jump in and use litigation as a way of obtaining rents from productive technology companies. So I don't think the patent troll business model is itself a problem. There are lots of non-practicing entities like universities that contribute to society, but it's suggestive, I think, of problems with the patent system. The idea that if I can produce a product, and especially the software or the internet industries, I'm going to be threatened by dozens or even hundreds of different patent owners all claiming a share of what I've created, that's a worrisome sign for the patent system.
So and there's been a lot of activity, obviously, over the last few years in patent reform, the American Invents Act and so forth. For setting the stage for really this discussion, what, if anything, has been done, if anything, over the last few years as part of patent reform and thinking about these issues to get at this problem from a policy perspective? Is there anything that up to now, we're going to talk about the legislation and administrative actions, but up as we stand here today or sit here today on April 8th, what has been done, if anything, to address this issue?
Well, in Congress, Congress passed in 2011 the America Invents Act, which was the most sweeping set of patent law reforms in the last 60 years. But very few of those reforms were actually directed at litigation abuse or patent trolls. The two that I think come closest were first, a change in the way we allow people to file patent lawsuits. So one of the things that had obscured the size of the patent troll issue during the 2000s was the fact that a patent troll would often sue 30 or 40 defendants in the same lawsuit. So if you just counted the number of lawsuits, it didn't look like there were that many patent troll cases. In 2011, we required you to sue each of those defendants in separate lawsuits. And one of the things we discovered was a huge jump in the number of lawsuits, but also a huge jump in the percentage of those lawsuits that were patent trolls. So that, I think, helped expose the problem, but it didn't really do much to address it. The other thing that we've done in the America Invents Act is to increase the use of administrative revocation procedures in the patent office. So while I have always been and still am entitled to challenge a patent in court and say it is invalid, we've made it easier for people to challenge patents in the patent office and try to get them revoked. And that challenge is somewhat cheaper than going to court.
So let me ask you this question from a political standpoint, because, you know, while certainly IP scholars and practitioners and certainly people focused on patents are familiar with this problem, it's unusual to see a specific issue in IP law get the attention of the president. Can you talk a little bit about the if you will, you know, the backstory politically as to how this issue got on the president's agenda?
Well, I don't know the answer to that personally, but what I suspect is going on is that the issue has become more and more salient, particularly in Silicon Valley, and the Obama administration has some fairly close ties into Silicon Valley and a particular interest in promoting innovation as one of the ways of driving growth in this country. So I think when President Obama and members of his staff sit down with folks in Silicon Valley, and for the first time they start talking about not just H-1 immigration visas, but the problems that patent law is providing for them. It's a real wake-up call for the administration. The traditional way I think government thinks of patents is, well, patents encourage innovation, and so more patents are better. And to hear the most productive sector of the economy saying patents are getting in the way of innovation, I think was a real shock.
You know, I was thinking about this too as I was thinking about our discussion today, and you, and again, by way of disclosure, Mark and I worked together in opposing a few years ago to Stop Online Piracy Act, which you know, in terms of killing legislation, not that that's the ultimate goal of what you want to do. Hopefully you have positive legislation comes out of it, but in this case, there was a coalition of organizations, right, and individuals and scholars that were able to kill this bill. I don't want to get into the merit of SOPA, but more to discuss it politically. And I'm curious whether you see a link between that victory from the perspective of those who wanted to kill it, which was really a first in certainly recent history in copyright law, where you had a pushback against, in that case, the entertainment industry, whether there's any connection between that issue getting national prominence and now this one. Is there any link at all politically or otherwise, or is that not a bridge worth building?
Well, I think one of the things that SOPA was a real wake-up call for folks in Congress that intellectual property issues had achieved political salience. And I think the folks in Congress had always proceeded in the copyright world by asking the big industry lobbyists what they thought and carving out rules that benefited both the copyright owners and the big transmitters like radio stations and cable and satellite companies. And suddenly here were 10 million people on a single day who called Congress, and they shut down the phone system and they overwhelmed Congress. And that left a really lasting scar on the psyche of a lot of folks in Congress. Now, I don't expect that we're going to hear 10 million people or even a million people calling their congressman to complain about patent trolls. But I think it meant two things of interest to Congress. One is that it signaled the growing power of the internet industries and indicated to folks on the Hill that they were a force to be reckoned with. So when the internet industries start talking about the problem of patent trolls, their credibility, I think, is larger than simply the sum of their campaign contributions. But the second thing it did is it meant that when people in Congress did start to hear from concerned constituents about the problem of patent trolls, they took notice. And that happened really in the last year or so, in part because of a change in the way a few patent owners have chosen to enforce their patents. There are a larger number of patent owners who are going after not the manufacturers of technology, but end users of that technology, even if those end users are people like dentists' offices or small businesses who are using a scanner in their office. And so when dentists' offices and small law firms started getting patent demand letters and they called their congressional representatives throughout the country, a bunch of representatives who never really had paid much attention to patent law because it didn't affect their lives started to take notice and to focus on the problem of litigation abuse.
We're chatting with Professor Mark Lemley of Stanford Law School on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Mark, I want to get into that legislation in a moment, but let me ask you a semantic question, which is, are you comfortable with the term or phrase or name patent troll, which obviously certainly sounds pejorative? Are you comfortable with that phrase, or do you prefer another name for these entities?
Oh, I'm fine calling patent troll a patent troll. I don't think it means that we need to sort of identify them and root them out. As I said earlier, I think patent trolls are a symptom of problems with the patent system. They are not themselves the problem. But neither do I think we have to try to come up with euphemisms. The like a patent assertion entity or non-practicing entity. The term patent troll itself was created as a compromise. The original term offered by Peter Detkin at Intel was patent extortionist, but the party that he called a patent extortionist then sued for defamation, so he came up with the patent troll as an alternative to try to describe what was going on.
And not long ago, I had Ron Epstein on, who I know you know, who also told stories around the creation of that name. Mark, let's turn towards what's going on now in Congress. You mentioned legislation in Congress. For those that aren't familiar with it, what are the reform proposals out there? And if you know, what is their status right now? Again, on April 8th, 2014.
Right. Well, so it's interesting you asked that question today. Mm-hmm. So there's a set of ideas that really are focused on patent litigation abuse. The single most significant one probably is fee shifting, is the idea that if I file or defend with a weak argument in a patent case, I might have to pay the other side's legal fees. And the idea there is that a number of these patent trolls have been able to hire contingency fee lawyers and bear virtually no cost themselves while imposing a pretty substantial cost on the people they sue. And in so doing, we've created a business model where I can sue you on a patent no matter how weak it is and persuade you to pay me six or even seven figures to go away just because it would cost you more to hire lawyers to defeat my patent. So there's a suite of reform proposals. We want to make it a little bit harder for people to file a frivolous lawsuit. We want to make it costly for them to do so by having to pay fees if they leave. Then there are other issues around the end user problem that I identified. Should I have to sue the manufacturer or at least let the manufacturer come in and defend the suit? And do I have to disclose who actually owns the patent because they're often owned by shell companies? So the House of Representatives last year quite quickly passed a legislative proposal along these lines by a fairly broad bipartisan margin, and the Senate has been considering similar bills. We were expecting to have the Senate bill marked up today in the Judiciary Committee. That got postponed, as it has a couple of times before, and it seems like there's starting to be some fracturing of the bipartisan consensus in the Senate around some of these reform efforts, particularly fee shifting, which is objected to by the trial lawyers associations. Mm-hmm. The markup is now scheduled for Thursday the 10th, and we'll see what happens then. But I think it's probably likely that some sort of bill is going to pass Congress this year, though it might not have all of the provisions that the House bill contained.
So the fee shifting issue, to talk about for a couple of minutes anyway, fee shifting doesn't have a strong history in U.S. law, and it's often perceived as a way to make it even more difficult for plaintiffs to bring lawsuits and to deter lawsuits, which I'm assuming, and I wasn't able to follow the issue today, is at the core of the objections in the Trial Lawyer Association. But I'm curious to get your take on that, and if I'm mischaracterizing the objection to it, tell me. But your take on that fee shifting issue, if for no other reason than again, it's not something that we generally do, at least in the United States.
So I think that's right, and I think the objections, if you were to tell the story from the perspective of those opposed to fee shifting, what they would say is it makes it harder to get access to the justice system because it makes it harder to be able to hire a lawyer on contingency fee, and. So if you're poor, the fact that I face the potential risk of having to pay the defendant's fees if I lose deters suits. I think it clearly deters frivolous suits, which it is supposed to do, but it might also deter some meritorious suits by people who find it harder to hire a lawyer to take their case if there's a downside risk as well. And so I think those things we have to trade off. And right now we've got quite a lot of suits filed on weak patents by people who have no intention of taking that case to trial ever, but who recognize that because they can impose massive litigation costs on their defendants, they can eke out a settlement in lieu of those litigation costs. And so fee shifting, I think, offers the promise that someone who wants to stand up to those weak plaintiffs and say, I'm going to fight and I'm going to invalidate your patent, now has will have a financial incentive to do so. So trading that off against the risk that that a little guy who has a meritorious case will not be able to bring it is the hard problem.
So Mark, let me give you one of the pushback arguments that I've heard as I've chatted with people who are not as concerned or about patent trolls as they are, and the argument is basically this: that those that want to fix this problem are painting with too broad a brush, that there are different kinds of patent trolls, quote unquote, and that some patent trolls in fact are positive; they do good things. For example, there are some quote unquote patent trolls that are able to inject resources into entities that don't have the resources to bring a patent to market, and therefore there are societal benefits. There are some patent trolls that, in fact, at one point did, in fact, practice, that is, they did use their patents to bring goods to market and then stopped, and now they're being labeled as patent trolls. So in other words, that it's a blunt instrument, and that we should, as a policy matter, be drawing a more fine line between the quote-unquote good and bad. Now, you've said earlier that, of course, there's a side problem here, which is that there are too many patents. Maybe that's part of the response, but I'm curious to get your response to that argument.
Well, it's certainly right that there are different types of patent trolls, and they're not all the same. One way you can slice it, as you've suggested, is to focus on who is this person and how did they come to own the patent. I think the canonical patent troll is in the business of buying up patents in order to assert them. But there are lots of folks, whether individuals who never developed a product, or companies who tried and failed to develop a product, or even universities, right, who are all non-practicing entities in this sense. I prefer to think a little bit about something different, which is sort of what's my business model, right? And so I distinguish between three different models for how I'm going to generate revenue as a patent troll. One, which we've already talked about, is the bottom feeder model, the people who are just out for cost of litigation settlements, and who don't care whether their patents are valid and infringed. There's a second model, which I call the lottery ticket model. And these people actually do have a patent that they consider to be valid and valuable. And what they're aiming for is a day in court in front of a jury where they think they can get often quite a lot of money, maybe hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars from the companies they're suing. And then there are companies like Intellectual Ventures, the patent aggregators, and they're going around and buying up hundreds and thousands and even tens of thousands of patents from all sorts of sources in the hopes that they can bypass the litigation process entirely and, like some large product-producing companies, use the size of their patent portfolio to negotiate licenses with people. And, you know, all of these patent owners have different characteristics, but I think all of the business models, we also ought to question whether they actually contribute to society in the long run. It seems to me the kind of most valuable, plausible ones in a perfect world would be the lottery ticket folks, right? If you've come up with an invention, there's a good argument that you ought to get paid a reasonable sum of money for it. Although the way our litigation system works, people are often aiming not for a reasonable sum of money, but for an unreasonable sum of money. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's driven patent trolls to file downstream lawsuits against customers is they're trying to increase their revenue by increasing the size of the royalty base. And so if I've invented a part of a semiconductor chip and I sue a supplier to a semiconductor company, I might get paid a reasonable royalty. But if I instead sue anybody who uses a computer or anybody who sells a computer and I say, all I want is 1% of the value of that computer, that's an argument that can be attractive to a jury, but which leads to systematic overcompensation because there are so many hundreds of thousands of patents out there that could potentially read on those technologies. So, I think the question at the end of the day is not are people getting paid? Is it desirable that some of the money from patent troll lawsuits goes to innovators? Yes, it is. To inventors? Yes, it is. But the real question is at what cost to society? And the most telling statistic that I've seen is that the more money you spend on research and development in the information technology industries, the more likely you are to be sued for patent infringement. Hmm. And if our patent system is supposed to be encouraging innovation, that strikes me as a very bad sign, not a good sign.
So, Mark, let me ask you one last question. By the way, I'm going to skip the crystal ball question. I'm not going to ask you to predict the future, particularly politically. But I will ask you this question related to it, which is in the midst of all of this legislative action, there's also been, again, very unusual, I think, administrative action as well. The Federal Trade Commission has been involved. And also, even more surprisingly, given that we're dealing with federal law, the New York State Attorney General that, under Spitzer, certainly famously went after some Wall Street folks several years ago, but even the New York AG has been involved in these issues. Can you say a few things or just give us an overview of the state of these administrative and legal actions at the state level?
Well, at the state level, lots of states have been going after particularly the folks who are sending thousands of threat letters to end users. And the legal hook is some variation of kind of deceptive practices or false advertising, that they're threatening to file a lawsuit and they're driving people to pay small, by patent standards, amounts of money, maybe $1,000, but they don't actually intend to file a lawsuit. So they're sort of obtaining this money under false pretenses. Patent law is federal. And so it's not obvious how much ability the states have to step in and regulate the enforcement activity of patent owners. Some of the defendants in these state cases have so far been fairly successful in arguing that federal law ought to preempt those state efforts. More interesting, I think, and we'll see what happens, is the potential role of the Federal Trade Commission, which has been conducting a study in this area, but which has also said, Commissioner Chairman Ramirez has said that the FTC might not wait until the outcome of that study before taking action against some of the more egregious patent trolls.
So we're talking with Professor Mark Lemley of Stanford Law School on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it is on KZSU-FM, which is Stanford's non-commercial, non-profit radio station that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu. Stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, please keep listening to the station. So Mark, let's turn in the second half of our show where we're taking a look at what's going on right now in patent law. We've got this incredibly deep and fairly diverse Supreme Court docket involving patents. And we won't be able to discuss all of the cases in the remaining time we have, but let's start off with this these cases involving claim construction. Now, we're getting even further into the weeds of patent law. Claims are the cliche is the meets and bounds of what a patent is. If a patentee wants to describe what it is that they claim to own and what it is that they want a government provide a monopoly on, they need to describe it in sufficient detail. So the claims are the heart of a patent. We've got a couple of cases in front of Supreme Court in involving claim construction and claims more broadly. Can you give us an overview, very briefly, of the facts of those cases, what the issues are that the court's dealing with on the claim side of, or the claim portion of patent law?
Well, so there are, I guess, two cases I'd focus on. One that will be decided this spring is the Nautilus versus Biosig case. And the issue there is a doctrine in patent law called indefiniteness. And the idea behind indefiniteness is people should be able to read the claims of a patent, the legal definition of the rights of that patent, and have some sense of whether or not what they're doing is infringing the, that patent. The Federal Circuit has interpreted that indefiniteness doctrine extremely narrowly, and the current Federal Circuit standard says that your patent claim is not invalid for indefiniteness unless it is, quote, insolubly ambiguous. And so the test essentially is, well, can we, with a team of lawyers, figure out some meaning for this term during the court process? Mm-hmm. And if we can, it's valid, and if not, then it's a problem. Very few cases, very few patents are invalidated under that standard. The Supreme Court has taken the Nautilus case to review the standard for indefiniteness, and I think it is worth noting that when you look at what the Supreme Court used to say in indefiniteness, and the cases, the last time they had an indefiniteness case was in the 1940s, the Supreme Court had a very different conception of what indefiniteness meant. The idea in those cases is a layperson, an engineer in this field, not a lawyer, ought to be able to look at this patent and know whether or not what they're doing is infringing. If that's the standard the court adopts, I think things are going to change pretty radically, that we're going to require a lot more precision from our patent applicants in writing patent claims, but also that a large swath of patents in all areas that have been issued over the last 20 years will be at risk.
Now, go ahead, Mark.
The other claim construction issue, which has been granted this term, although will be heard next term, has to do with the question of how we interpret patent claims, and in particular, whether the Court of Appeals has to defer to the district court in the interpretation of patent claims. District judges and litigants have been concerned for some time that the Federal Circuit has a very high claim construction reversal rate. It often undoes what the district court did, and so they've been pushing for deference to district court decisions. The Federal Circuit just recently reaffirmed its rule that construing patent claims is a legal question. It's just about the interpretation of legal documents, and so it ought to be reviewed without any deference. And the Supreme Court, I think, will wade into that issue next year.
Now, when we talk about claims, right, I mean, we're dealing with language, and the process for construing and constructing claims is kind of like a mini trial, which is really, you know, certainly from a legal perspective, pretty interesting. In order to understand this issue, can you describe briefly what these hearings are within patent litigation, where claims are interpreted so that there is an understanding of what, in fact, has been patented?
Sure. So when I write a patent, the most important part of that document is the claim, which is the legal definition of the invention. I get multiple bites at the apple, multiple different claims in my patent. And, you know, in theory, the words of those claims will define the boundaries of the invention. They'll tell the world what I own and what I don't own. But the problem is that words are not particularly good at defining concepts, and especially not new concepts that are unfamiliar, as we're usually dealing with in patent law. And so there's a lot of ambiguity in the meaning of those patent claim terms. Sometimes that ambiguity is technical. A term might mean different things to different people in a field or at different times, but some of it just comes from the inherent imprecision of language. And so we've had Federal Circuit cases considering and in some cases coming to different decisions about the meaning of terms as simple as A, to, when, through, and or. Because in different contexts, each of those terms can mean different things. So the process of figuring out what those claims mean is a process that's given to the district court, not to the jury. And the district court does it pre-trial in what's called a Markman hearing after the case that gave rise to the hearing. And sometimes those hearings include evidence. I might bring in an expert who says the term 1,2-dichloroethylene has this particular meaning to a chemist. But sometimes they just include argument about the context of the invention, the patent, what the patentee built, how they described it, and the process of getting that patent through the patent office in an effort to replace the words of the patent claim with other theoretically clearer words that explain the context of that claim.
How much of what we're talking about when we're talking about patent claim constructions is built around the traditional contract type principles for dealing with ambiguity? Because when you use phrases like solidly ambiguous, of course it harkens back to all of the issues we have in contracts, which has led me to wonder, and of course to get your take on it, whether patent law in a sense is in any way reinventing the wheel. What's different about patent claim construction versus contract interpretation and construction?
Right. Well, so we have a couple of differences. It's, you know, patent claim construction is somewhat like contract construction. It's somewhat like statutory interpretation, but it's not exactly like either of those things. In each of those three cases, we're taking a document of legal significance and we're trying to give it meaning in a particular context. In contract law, we've got two parties negotiating something. We want to know what they actually thought, what was their intent. We have a rule that says we'll interpret ambiguities against the drafter. In patent law, by contrast, while we're using many of the same tools, we're looking at the plain meaning, we're looking at the surrounding context, at any negotiations that happened, our objective is not figure out what the patentee intended, usually, but figure out what an ordinary scientist in this field would understand this claim to mean. So we're actually not looking so much at the intent of the parties. We're looking more at the question of how the outside world would understand this claim.
Now, with regard to these two cases, of course, it's the same kind of question I asked before with regard to patent trolls. Is there any particular reason, is it just luck of the draw, that we have two cases in front of the Supreme Court involving the relatively specific question of patent claims? Can you explain, or do you have any theories as to why the Supreme Court granted cert on these cases?
Well, I think the broader context is actually rather more remarkable. We have 7 pending patent cases in the U.S. Supreme Court and 11 total intellectual property cases. That is more than we've had since the 1880s, when the Supreme Court didn't have a choice and it had to take patent appeals. So it really is to say a banner year is an understatement. It's an astonishing year for patent cases. And so I think given that context, the fact that at least two of them deal with patent claim interpretation is not all that surprising, because claim interpretation and the scope of claims is so central to what patent law does.
So in the remaining, Mark, and we have maybe about 14 minutes, of those other 5 cases, I mean, there are several that I think are interesting. What appears to be a potential revisiting of this, of another tricky issue in patent law, which is this issue of the patentability of abstract ideas. And we've got another case which may add to the earlier case, not that long ago, Bilski, that dealt with this issue. Can you talk a little bit about that case and abstract ideas and patentability?
Sure. So the question at issue here is patentable subject matter, which is the gatekeeper, the sort of threshold for all the rest of patent law. In general, we define the scope of patent protection the universe of possible things that could be patented quite broadly. But we have some significant limitations on that scope. We will not allow you to patent products of nature, for instance, or laws of nature. And we also won't allow you to patent abstract ideas. And the Supreme Court has been struggling in the last 4 years with the meaning and scope of those restrictions. This is the fourth patentable subject matter case it's taken since 2010. By contrast, in the 25 years before that, it had exactly one patentable subject matter case. So it really is, I think, trying to figure out the details here. In the Bilski versus Kapos case in 2010, I think the court set out some principles that it thought would help to govern figuring out when a claim is too abstract. But the Federal Circuit has been unable or unwilling to apply those principles in a straightforward way to reach results that the judges can agree on. And so in the case that they have before them right now, Alice versus CLS Bank, the Federal Circuit, sitting as a full court, split 5-5 on the question of whether the claims here were patentable subject matter, and even on the question of how to go about figuring that out. So at stake is potentially something as broad as, do we patent software at all? Although I think it's unlikely the court's going to say you can't have a software patent. But also, more realistically, the question of whether just taking an idea and implementing it in a general purpose computer renders that idea patent eligible. And by all accounts from the oral argument, it looks like the court is inclined to say no.
Now, in the last several years, I've had a few guests on that have talked about this concept of ownership of ideas, or ownership of facts, if you will. Ben Clemens, several years ago, wrote a terrific book, Math You Can't Use, talking about the ownership of mathematical equations and algorithms. And my question for you, really, and you've taken positions on this, but I want to ask you, in light of these cases, I mean, what's your take on the breadth of patentable subject matter, particularly as it relates to this abstract idea issue? Because software patents and business method patents have been, over the last several years, another, along with patent trolls, really, at least from my perspective, the second hottest issue, if you will, around patents. What's your take as it stands today on the need to tailor patentable subject matter to perhaps exclude some of these categories?
Well, I think the problem is the problems are not unrelated. It's no accident that the patent troll problem is primarily a software and internet problem. Mm-hmm. Many of the things that are driving concerns about one are also driving concerns about the other. The patents are least certain here; they're most ambiguous. You need multiple different inventions pulled together to make a product work, and so there's just a thicket of patents out there. Because the technology moves so quickly, we're almost always trying to apply old claims written for obsolete technology to new defendants. And all of those things, I think, give rise to the sort of uncertainty that allows patent trolls to flourish. So there's a kind of sense that there's a real problem and we need to do something about it. And I think that sense is correct. I think if you ask most of the people who do innovating in the software world, particularly the smaller and the startup companies who you'd expect to be the ones who would most need legal protection, they'll tell you that software patents are a problem, that they are a cost to them and not a benefit. That said, I'm somewhat troubled by the patentable subject matter doctrine being used as the target here, simply because it's not obvious that we're going to be able to come up with a good workable test that will enable us to distinguish patentable from unpatentable things in the software world. Mm-hmm. You could imagine saying, we just don't allow patents for certain kinds of technologies, banning software patents or banning business method patents. Short of doing that, it's hard to come up with a clear dividing line that says some things within software are patentable and others aren't. And I think we've seen both the Federal Circuit and now the Supreme Court really struggling with that.
When we think about, and again, you know, we're closing in on maybe about 7 minutes here. When we're thinking about these issues, I think it ties into what to me is the most interesting conceptually case that, and the last case we'll talk about on the show today, the Limelight case involving this interesting, and again, we're digging deeper into patent law, but this is fascinating. This concept of inducing infringement by performance, or what's known as divided infringement. Before we talk about the issue that the court is facing there, what on God's earth is that?
The doctrine of infringement defined by the patent claims requires that somebody be an infringer, right? Somebody perform each and every one of the steps of the patent claim. And what we've encountered in the computer and internet context in particular is a variety of circumstances in which there's no one actor who does all of the steps of the patent claim. So an example might be a patent claim that says step one performed by a client computer and step two performed by a server computer. And if you happen to own both, then you could be liable for infringing that claim. But if one company owns a client and an unrelated company owns a server computer, each one of them is performing a step, but there's no individual who is actually engaging in all of the steps necessary for patent infringement. So the question is, what do we do in that situation? The law has said until quite recently, if there's nobody who's actually infringing, or at least kind of in charge directing other people to infringe, then there can't be an act of patent infringement. And in these so-called divided infringement situations, the answer is all the steps are being performed, but there is no individual who is guilty of infringement, and so the patent owner has no one to sue. The Federal Circuit in the Limelight case changed that rule, adopted a new technology focused rule designed to enable patent owners to sue somebody in that circumstance, even though there was no one who was actually an infringer. The Supreme Court has granted certiorari and I think is likely to go back to the rule the way it was before, not necessarily because of a deep policy concern, but because it's hard to read the statute to reach the result that the Federal Circuit did.
It would seem to, of course, push against this broad concern about patent litigation being vexatious and being a drag on the economy to open up more ways for patent owners to bring infringement cases. Am I reading that issue too narrowly?
I think there's a real risk, depending on how we define the rule, that you would open up an entire new front for the patent trolls. And in particular, some people, only one of the judges in the en banc Federal Circuit, but curiously, the American Intellectual Property Law Association have taken the position that you ought to be liable not just for kind of inducing or causing this sort of divided infringement, but you ought to be directly liable if you're a participant in any one of the steps. And if that were right, then I think we'd have a real problem, right? So patent owners could sue computer manufacturers and say, well, you made a computer, and a computer is one element of my patent claims. So even though somebody else infringed and you knew nothing about it, you're now a direct infringer. Or they could sue telephone companies or electric power companies and say, providing power or providing network service is an element of my patent claims. And so you're liable as a direct infringer, even though you have nothing to do with the real meat of the patent claims. So I think the reasons that the court had originally concluded that we're not going to hold you liable unless you really do perform or direct others to perform all the steps of a patent claim are good reasons. If we're not careful, we could end up multiplying liability quite a bit in the context of the internet.
Mark, in the last few minutes that we have, I want to ask you a question that's really aimed more at the academics and researchers that are listening to the show, and there are a lot of those, which is why I ask it. You know, there's been a growth in empirical research in patent law and really in IP over the last several years. I mean, certainly when SOAP and PIPA was being argued, you know, I and you and others had asked for evidence of harm, and it was difficult to come about. We have similar issues in patents, and there's been other areas where we've seen growth in scholarship. If you were setting a research agenda for patent scholars writ large over the next couple of years, where you would like to see more thinking done, both from a theoretical and a practical or policy perspective, what would that agenda look like? What can you identify a couple of three issues, and again, recognizing that you may be writing in them as well, but broad areas where you think more work needs to be done by scholars and researchers to get at the myriad of issues specifically in patent law?
Well, I think one thing where we've started to see a lot of work done, but you could use more, is to focus on the industry-specific differences in how the patent system drives or hinders innovation. We've seen a lot of research on the relationship between patents and innovation, but the answer has increasingly been it's complicated. And it's complicated because whether or not patents are driving innovation is often a function of what industry you're in, how big or small your company is, how new or old your company is, the kinds of technologies we're talking about. So trying to flesh out that relationship, I think, is important. Beyond that, I think from the litigation perspective, we've started to see some work done in identifying and categorizing different kinds of patent cases. And with respect to patent trolls, which we've been talking about, they often hide behind shell companies. And so figuring out even exactly who's bringing lawsuits, how many times they're double-dipping, suing a company, getting a settlement, and then coming back a week later with another name to try it all over again would be helpful. And finally, and I think most importantly, although also hardest, the number of cases that go to court is the tip of the iceberg. What we'd love to have more information on are the cases that settle, and even the cases that are never brought, the licensing transactions, the negotiations that occur in the shadow of litigation, because I think that would give us a better estimate of the kind of real costs and benefits of the patent system, whether we're seeing it used in real technology transfer, and if so, under what circumstances, or whether it's really just imposing a cost on the people who are innovating.
Professor Mark Lemley, William H. Newcomb Professor of Law, repeat hearsay culture guest, joining us from his office at Stanford Law School. Mark, thank you so much for being on the show today. There's obviously a lot to pay attention to in patent law. I look forward to having you back on the show after we have a few more decisions to discuss your take on them and where we're headed next. But meanwhile, thank you so much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you.
So I'm excited to mention this upcoming quarter, the guests that we have coming on who are going to be touching on a range of technology and policy issues that we focus on in Hearsay Culture. I'm still putting together the schedule this week, but I'm happy to announce a few guests that are coming on. Next week, I'm going to be having on Luzevice van der Laan, who is a former member of the EU, as well as a Dutch parliamentarian who's going to be talking about e-democracy democracy issues. In addition, my colleague Laura Rozelle from Elon University is going to be on with her co-author discussing communications in international policymaking, which of course is a huge issue right now in IP and technology law. I'm also going to be having on other guests that focus on a range of issues involving IP as well as robotics and what is now being called over the last year the Internet of Things and drones. So there's a lot going on that we are going to be digging into over this quarter. As I mentioned in the beginning of the show, I announced during the interim period that Professor Julie Cromer-Young from Thomas Jefferson Law School has joined Hearsay Culture as a blogger. I'm very excited to have Julie on. She is someone who whose work I paid attention to for the last several years. She focuses on copyright as well as civil procedural issues. And these procedural issues, as Larry Lessig has said, with regard to campaign finance, are not always the most important issue, but they're the first issue. And that's a way of thinking about procedural issues that I think we need to spend more time with if we want the kind of substantive law, balanced law, or what have you, in intellectual property and the Internet. We need to deal with these procedural issues. Indeed, Mark was talking about some of them with regard to things like claim construction, which have this both procedural and substantive element to them. So Hearsay Culture is going to be looking in those directions as well. Importantly to note, and I make pains to do this, Hearsay Culture is not a show about my interest, that is Levine's interest, but rather I focus on issues that I think need more attention and that should have attention across a range of issues in IP and technology, regardless of whether I work on them or write on them. And so to that extent, if there are people that you'd like to have on the show or issues that you think should be covered and they haven't been covered, I encourage you to email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. I have received a number of emails over the last year from people who want to be on the show. I'd love to have everyone on the show who wants to be on the show. I do my best to, again, go through a broad range of areas. And so I welcome your suggestions, both if you'd like to be on the show, if you're a listener, or others you think should be on the show. Again, dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to the show. You can listen this quarter. Again, it's going to be on 3 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays on KZSU, which you can tune in the Bay Area or stream live at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can then get the show via podcast by going to the Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, by going to the iTunes page for Stanford CIS, or by going to my webpage at hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 200-plus shows as well as the upcoming schedule. So, again, email me if you have any comments, suggestions, feedback, and what have you at dave@hearsayculture.com. Otherwise, thank you for listening today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.